I'm Steve Bigeau, and this is Down Home Corner. Are you from Canada's East Coast, proud of your roots? Well, you are a down-homer, and we are all connected. On this episode, we connect with Campbellton, New Brunswick's Byron Christopher, and from Canadian history, David Milgaard. Welcome to the show. So glad to have you back for season two of Down Home Corner. Proud to be back, too. Really proud of our guest for this episode, Campbellton's Byron Christopher, journalist, author, broadcaster. You may know of some of his more famous interviews featured on CBC, Maclean's Magazine, Today Magazine, a famous newspaper supplement of the 70s and 80s. Well, one of Byron's most famous interviews, of course, was with David Milgaard, wrongfully convicted, then 23 years later exonerated. Now, here's an exclusive. David Milgaard is on this episode. Yes, Canada's most famous or infamous wrongful conviction cases, the man who rarely does interviews, is on this show. My promise to you is that this show will continue to grow, continue to evolve, continue to serve you, and because of your help and support, continue to reach more and more down-homers. We connect because of you, and we are all connected, right? Well, please share this show and every episode on social media, whether it's Facebook, Twitter, Snapchat, whatever. Every share expands our show. And now, one more big favor, okay? This show needs to link up with terrestrial radio or satellite radio. So we need you to help this happen, okay? You can make a difference. Contact your favorite radio station and tell them you want to hear this show on their radio station. Or even contact the stations you don't like. See, if we get enough people contacting them, they'll get an interest. And eventually, somebody will link up to the show. And eventually, we'll get a whole network going. So this is all depending on you. You can help us out. And thank you for your support. By the way, coming up real soon, we got Byron Christopher and a man from Canada's history, David Milgaard. But first, it's time to get off your ass and dance.
The room which starts to rumbling with the drone of his guitar. Terry Mann's a mandolin to liven up the bar. Brian breaks the ball, run out the party to enhance. And someone shouts, the time's about, get off your ass and dance. There's jumping and bumping and flipping and humping and lumping across the floor. The boggy cranks another round, the crowd calls out for more. Partners are swinging and all heads are singing, you might as well take a chance. There's no point sitting there alone, get off your ass and dance. Oh!
But I'm just standing there with your jaws hanging open, crank off a verse.
Right! The boys are rattling on the spoons, the gals on tambourines. A beauty's on the ugly stick, the best you've ever seen. Your man is on a washboard tie, his fingers they to France. Hey you, there's more room on the floor, get off your ass and dance. There's jumping and bumping and thumping and humping and lumping across the floor. The barkeep cranks another round, the crowd calls out for more. Partners are swinging and all hands are singing, you might as well take a chance. There's no point sitting there alone, get off your ass and dance. Hey!
Your friends and neighbors, call up your family too. For if you're 9 or 90, there's a dance floor here for you. Get on your bib and tucker, get on your party pants. Come share a keg and shake a leg, get off your ass and dance. There's jumping and bumping and thumping and hopping and lumping across the floor. The barkeep cranks another round, the crowd calls out for more. Partners are swinging and all hands are singing, you might as well take a chance. There's no point sitting there alone, get off your ass and dance. There's jumping and bumping and thumping and hopping and lumping across the floor. The barkeep cranks another round, the crowd calls out for more. Partners are swinging and all hands are singing, you might as well take a chance. There's no point sitting there alone.
alone. Get off your ass and dance.
Yeah, you.
Get off your ass and dance. Get off your ass and dance.
What do we do now?
They are called The Saunders Brothers Show and Get Off Your Ass and Dance. Comedy kitchen parties all over Nova Scotia. Original music and comedy. And we'll have Ed Saunders on an upcoming show. But right now, this episode. You know, people often ask artists, why do you do what you do? And the most cliche, but yet the most honest answer is, because I have to. Well, Byron Christopher is a good example of that. A journalist, crime reporter, author, broadcaster, and blogger, the cowboy hat that Byron wears seems to depend on the story or the subject he's covering. Those skills, along with honest-to-goodness East Coast values and hard work, took him from Duncan Street in Campbellton to Nepal, Australia, Sweden, Nicaragua, and around the world. Many of his interviews and exclusives marking the newsworthy subject's first contact with the media. Wrongfully convicted David Milgaard and Colin Thatcher would be examples of that. And even a man on the top 15 most wanted list, Richard Lee McNair, who escaped from maximum security in Louisiana only to be captured in all places, Campbellton, New Brunswick. Well, Byron's interviewed them all and many more. A good story is often marked by details, and oftentimes those very details or attention to detail help police uncover facts that led to overturns and wrongful convictions and help convict the guilty parties. Byron leaves his mark on every story he covers and a footprint nearly everywhere he goes. And now he visits our little down-home corner.
Well, the legendary Byron Christopher, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for being on the show, and thank you so much for supporting the program as well, Byron.
Well, thank you, Steve. It's an honor. You know, you're from Campbellton. It's strange we've never met. Isn't that funny? You're from Campbellton. I guess it shows the age gap there. I left when I was 18, and that was back in 1967. So I don't know where you were then, but we have something in common. We both work at CKNB, and we know people like Donnie Hume, Terry Adams, and the crew.
Mm-hmm.
And that's pretty cool. Thank you for asking me to be on your show. I appreciate that.
Now, what's a down-homer to you, Byron?
Well, it's someone from the Maritimes who perhaps left, and if they did leave, they left a part of themselves back there, and that's their heart. And I think there's thousands of us who have left the Maritimes or Atlantic Canada and long for home, and I've sensed that feeling to be stronger with the Maritimes or Atlantic Canada than any other part of Canada. I've never heard anyone say, you know, I miss Mississauga, I miss Etobicoke, or whatever. No, you just don't hear that. But you do hear people say that a lot about the Maritimes, and many of them do go home. And now we go home electronically every hour. We do that on the internet. So to me, it's a touch base with home.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the whole idea, too, of this show, and it was initially inspired by the Facebook page, Down Homers Are Us, which is kind of another version of it, you know? But I've always wondered about that draw. I mean, I know in small town anywhere, there's always going to be a draw for you to come back home, or in some cases to avoid, like, the plague, you know, for some people. But I've always thought the East Coast of Canada is a special one. Now, you've lived around the world. You've been in Australia. You've seen small towns everywhere. Do you think it's different or special?
Yes. And as you make a good point when you say that's true of all small towns. And I think that that is. Perhaps another analogy is that the Maritimes is one big small town.
Mm.
Well, you know, there's a special feeling there. I can't describe it any other way. It's a bit like asking me, well, why'd you fall in love with this person? Well, then, you know, you can explain it, but you can't really fully because you can't, the words aren't there to describe that kind of feeling. But there is a longing. I've always felt excited when my plane touches down in Moncton or wherever, saying, wow, I'm back again. And the first thing I notice all the New Brunswick license plates. You know, it's just a good feeling. It'll be like that, and I'm sure until I'm 115 or whatever, still be the same feeling because it's home, and home was special.
Mm, very special. You know, it's funny you talk about New Brunswick license plates. If I'm in Ontario, where I live most of the time, and if I see a New Brunswick license plate, look, a plate, you know, and I notice it right away. When I go home on vacation, it takes me the first day to stop doing that. I'm home. They're all New Brunswick plates.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, I'm the same way. I get excited. And I'm from Campbellton. So I really get excited when I'm in my rental and I'm driving north from Bathurst on that highway. I forget, Highway 11, I guess it is. And then I can see the Sugarloaf in the distance, like a hump stuck out of nowhere, you know. And wow, this Campbellton isn't far away. And I've got my radio on, and I tune it to 950 AM dial, and there's CKNB. It doesn't matter what it is, it could be a commercial. I'm excited to hear it because it's Campbellton. But that's me. I'm sure people feel the same way about Tidehead or Matapedia or even Dalhousie. I'm just kidding.
You've had a remarkable career, Byron. I mean, the envy of a lot of people, and you've worn a lot of different hats, and maybe that's part of the reason for your success. You were always adapting and changing to your surroundings kind of thing. But you've done so many exclusive interviews and interviews with subjects who did interviews for the very first time talking to media. Now, we can't list them all, but tell us a couple of them, and what is it about you that made them want to talk to you and you alone?
I'm not sure of that. I get asked that every now and then, and I don't know how to answer it without sounding like you're bragging, you know. I try to be me, and I think that's part of it, just as you are yourself. There's nothing, you're not pontificating when you talk to me. You're real. And I think I try to show that when I meet people. I don't use any big words, but then again, you only got the grade four. What do you expect? Just kidding. But yeah, hey, you're slow today.
You know? Slow.
No, and I try to interject humor and, you know, be honest with them and try to keep my word. I'll phone them, but when I say I'm phoning you back at this time, I do. And I'll meet you at this time. I do meet them at that time. And I don't know. It's a hard one to answer why they'd want to talk to me. But I think maybe part of it is maybe a reputation. If you do, I was on a prison beat for years, and word got around that I was often in the joint. So many of the those convicted of the big crimes would reach out or at least open their door to me, and that helped a lot. But I try to be me, and I try to be real, and I hope it isn't just something I put on for work. That way, if I were conducting an interview, and once the interview is done, I'm the same person. I think Peter Marr's like that. Mm. I think Don Hume was like that. And then they're from Campbellton. So that might be it. But I'm, and I don't see it as anything great, but some people do. You know, if you land a big interview, sure, you're excited about it, but then you move on to the next story. And then you look back at it and someone says, hey, your work is mentioned in a song here. Oh, really? How'd that come about? That's weird. You know, it's the way I would look at it. Or that you're on Wikipedia, and I say, that's weird. You know, well, it's kind of nice, but it's still kind of strange. You know, I'm still in awe of that in that respect. I would have been 6 or 7 years old. My brother, Arnold, was 2 years younger. And we were in the backyard. I lived on Duncan Street, 90 Duncan Street. And the next door neighbors, 92 Duncan Street. There were a family there, and I could hear this yelling, shouting. And I looked up to see one man chasing another, and he had a big knife, big kitchen knife. and I'll use their initials, Roy Clayton and Johnny. I never knew Johnny's last name, but it came out in this chase across the field. His last name was Pitch because he was being called a son of a bitch. And he was chasing this guy across the field through the high grass. And Arnold looked at me and I looked at him. And this was exciting stuff, you know. Apparently, Johnny was a boarder there. And he, to put it subtly, he went into the wrong bedroom, I guess. And he got caught. So here was Johnny being chased by Roy. And I think he wanted to give him a vasectomy, though I'm not sure. But he never caught him. Johnny was faster of the two, and he outran him. But I remember thinking, man, you know, later on, it would have been good to report on that story, you know, for CKNB. But it never happened.
The seed was planted.
Yeah, it was. But, you know, there's often another side to the story. And years later, not that many years later, things had turned around. They became friends. And it was around the time that we got television, Camelton. Johnny was at the top of this two- or three-story house trying to adjust an antenna on the roof. And down below in one of the windows was Roy. And he was yelling out, move it to the right. No, to the left. No, no, to the right. And Johnny's trying to keep his balance because if he falls, you know, his injury is going to be worse than a vasectomy with a kitchen knife, I'll tell you. But anyway, he's up there trying to keep his balance and trying to move the antenna. And he finally has enough and he yells out to Roy, Roy, why don't you stick the goddamn thing up your arse? You can see China then. And I thought, wow, what a line, you know? But that's my first taste of news. But even going back before then, when I would have been 5, 6 years old, I'm not sure, I was going to the Rosebery Street School, where there's a McDonald's now. For Christmas that year, I got a crystal radio set. My father put it together, and I remember listening by the window and going to bed at night. I was so fascinating that I could hear radio that was my own, very own, and I had to wear these headphones. And I was so excited. I even listened to CBC broadcasts for an hour in the evening just to say, wow, this is so cool. And as I got older, we had a big floor radio, a large one. And it had shortwave, and I would tune in to the stations in Europe, not understanding what they were saying, but thinking, this is great. These stations are somewhere in Germany or Holland or France, you know, and I'm listening to them. Mm-hmm. So that always fascinated me. But even before then, when I'm in, I don't know, four or five years old, there was a vehicle driving around Camelton that had speakers on top, and they were announcing either a boxing match at the Gardens, Memorial Gardens, or some big event. I forget now what it was. But I remember thinking, you know, wouldn't it be nice to drive around and play music for the people? Mm-hmm. So, and I've thought about that many times. I was sitting there on the front steps watching this car go by and listening to the guy read over and over again the announcement, thinking it'd be nice to play music for people. So those are some of the memories I can share with you of my early days in Camelton.
You're listening to Down Home Corner. Please remember to share this episode on social media, whether it's Facebook, Twitter, or whatever. Every share helps us connect to more and more down-homers. Now back to the show with our guest, Byron Christopher, where we're talking about one of his most famous interviews with Colin Thatcher.
Colin Thatcher was a provincial cabinet minister from Saskatchewan who went down for the murder of his former wife, Joanne Wilson. He got 25 years for that, and he was sent to the federal prison in Edmonton, known as the Max here, and everyone wanted to interview him. I mean, everyone. And so did I. And I approached the head of the inmates committee there, whose name was Johnny Shimmons. I said, can you get Thatcher to the phone? And I guess he did. And I went out to the Max, and there was Colin Thatcher sitting in the lawyer's room on a chair, leaning back a bit. He was wearing that green prisoner uniform they have. And I remember it stenciled on his chest was his name, Thatcher, stenciled in white. So I walked over and I shook hands and I said, my name's Byron. He said, I know who you are. And I said, I know who you are too. But he could tell the way his arms were folded, he didn't want to talk. He may have talked, but he wasn't anxious. I said, okay, I put the machine down, my tape recorder down on the table there by him, and I popped the lid, and I pulled out a cassette. I said, "See this? It belongs to you. I'm giving it to you." I put it back into the machine. I said, "We'll do the interview on this cassette. But if you think I've mistreated you or booby-trapped any questions in that, you keep your tape. It's as simple as that, Colin." So we shook on it, and it was a good interview. I didn't mistreat him, and I treated him fairly, and one thing led to another. And that was a big interview. You know, I was working for CBC Radio News at the time. That was a national story. It was bigger in Western Canada, of course, than in Eastern Canada. But I think it led CBC National News that morning. So that was another big one.
Led to a story in Maclean's magazine as well.
Yeah, years later, when Thatcher was released, he was under pressure to give interviews again. And I worked on him to get that interview. He wasn't talking to anybody. In fact, he had said he would never give another interview again. But he was out in Edmonton to visit a pastor friend, a prison pastor friend. And they invited me for lunch. It was at a place called Swiss Chalet. Remember that? In the west end of Edmonton. The three of us sat there at an open table. There was no booth. And Thatcher was there. The pastor was there. And I was there. And I remember a man walking by us. He stopped right in his tracks. He looked at Colin Thatcher. And he looked at me. And he looked at Thatcher and at me. And then he proceeded to go to the washroom. And I said to Thatcher, I said, "That guy recognized you." So Thatcher put on his sunglasses. He said, "Is the media coming around here soon?" And I said, "Maybe. I don't know if he's connected to the media. But he knows who you are," and he kept looking at me as well. So, but I asked him how he was doing, and he said that he's trying to get his life in order. And I said, "Why don't you write about it? Why don't you write a book about it?" And he said, "Well, Byron, I'm fed up with that stuff." And I said, "Well, don't you have the material? I mean, you had a computer in your cell. And I think you were writing notes all the time." He said, "Yeah, I do. It's hard to bring it up again." And I said, "Well, people need to hear your point of view, and I don't think it's out there, quite frankly." He said, "Well, let me think about it." So I phoned him, and he said, "Yes, I decided to do that book." And at that point, we did an interview, and that was huge. That was a massive interview. That was for a private radio station in Edmonton called 630 CHED, C-H-E-D. It was number one in the ratings. It may still be. A lot of stations out here, and that was number one. So it got a lot of coverage. Canadian Press was given an advance copy of the interview. So they wrote their wire copy up and were ready to go when we released it in the morning. So, and next came the book. The book was about to be released, and I canvassed people in the media to see who'd be interested in a feature story on Colin Thatcher in his book, and quite a few were. CTV was very interested, so was Canadian Press, but of course they all wanted to do it themselves, and I said, "That's not going to happen because he's only talking to me initially." So, but I sold that story to Maclean's magazine, and I remember driving over to, we agreed to meet in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, on this day. And the day before, there was a courier at my door. The doorbell rang. There was a courier, and I was given a copy, an advance copy of Colin Thatcher's book. And off I drove to Moose Jaw all the way, and I got there in the evening. And I began reading the book. I finished the book at 3 in the morning, made notes. And he said he would be there at 8 in the morning, this motel. So, at sure enough, at 8, I'm in my pajamas or something, and there's my phone rings in my room, and it's Thatcher. And so I go up to greet him, I bring him back into the room, and he says, "Oh, you've given you the executive suite here. It's a big one." Yeah, it's strange because that's not the room I booked. I booked a small room. Of course, Maclean's magazine was paying for it. But this is an interesting sidebar story. And I said, "Colin, I was reading your book around 2 in the morning, and I turned to my right. I looked up in the ceiling, and you can see up there there's a vent. But I said, there's something inside that vent. and it's not just normal equipment. And I remember the way he stood up, he said, let's get out of here. We left, and that's why we did the interview in a park. I got dressed, and we had a drive in his big pickup truck, a diesel truck. Climbed up in that, and I remember seeing a road sign that said Thatcher Avenue. It's named after his dad, who used to be the premier. And I said, Colin, you're not hated that much here. They named a street after you. Look at that. It was after his dad, of course. So we arrived there in the park and sat down at a park bench, and there was some guy cutting grass, making noise. Remember that? And I had a list of 45 questions or something. So once maintenance guy was done with his work, we got into the interview, and he answered all the questions. And we shook hands and drove me back to where my car was parked at the motel, and I made my way back to Edmonton at Fallon McLean's. Say the interview was in the can, and I'd be back in Edmonton at this time. I arrived late in the evening, maybe 9 o'clock. Would have been late in Toronto, but they had one of the editors stay up late to handle the tape. I fed the tape down, and they worked on it until, I don't know, some hour. And it was their cover story. They got it out in a couple of days. McLean's phoned to say it would be out, and he said, do you realize it is the cover story? And I said, no, you didn't tell me that. But it was. Yeah, I was at a Shoppers Drug Mart store and going out one day, and, well, there was Colin Thatcher's face on the front page. So I picked up a couple of copies, and, yeah. I phoned Thatcher, and I said, you're on the front page of McLean's. He said, oh, I figured that. So, and that was a huge interview. And I said to Thatcher, I said, now, hold off for a few days. Don't give any interviews because you're tired. Whatever. And he did hold off. And then finally the media's just frothing, you know, to get their shot at Thatcher. And I guess he brought them all to the same place, the park and that. He said one guy even arrived with McLean's magazine story there.
You're listening to Down Home Corner. Thanks for listening. Please contact your favorite radio station and tell them you want to hear this show on their radio station. You can contact the ones you don't like, too. Now back to our program with our guest, Byron Christopher. One of his most famous and exclusive interviews was with David Milgaard. Now, Byron, I know the David Milgaard case was a famous case in the day, but what drew you to the case to begin with?
I think it happened long before there was any mention of David Milgaard possibly being innocent, long before then. And that was at the time he was convicted. And that was back in 1969 or 70, I can't recall exactly. I was working at a radio and a television station combined in British Columbia as a disc jockey there. And of course, as you know, at the small stations, you read news as well. And I was reading news, and I came across this item of a 16-year-old in Saskatoon who'd been found guilty of the rape and murder of a young nursing assistant who was in her teens. And I remember thinking at the time, that's an awful story. Why would the guy do that? And I just remember that it kind of stands out of many of the stories you read, you know, because it was so gross. And that's my first connection with him. And the years go by, and I would think about him over time, wondering how that killer is doing. And then I got involved in a prison beat myself in Edmonton when I worked with CBC Radio News. I was often out at the prison. And there was a guy out there who told me he knew David Milgaard was innocent. And I said, well, how do you know that? He said, because I spoke to the killer. And he told me that he killed Gil Miller. And he gave me a name, and it was Larry Fisher. I said, I didn't know that. It's the first time I've heard sort of a pseudo confirmation of that. So I began to work on his file. And then by coincidence, I received a phone call out of the blue from none other than David Milgaard one night. This was in the early 90s. He called me at home at my apartment in South Edmonton. Call came in around supper time. And he told me who he was. He was phoning from this penitentiary north of Winnipeg. I said, yes, I know who you are, and this is who I am. He said, the reason I'm phoning you is I understand that you've worked on a file where there was a double homicide at a penitentiary in Saskatchewan? I said, yes, I did. I asked him how he got my name and number, and he told me. And then he proceeded to ask me a few questions about the shooting. A number of prisoners, I think there were three, had taken part in a hostage taking. And the guards ended it by killing two of the hostage takers. One survived. And David Milgaard wanted to know if one of the dead hostage takers, who happened to be from Newfoundland, his name was McDonald, he wanted to know if he suffered before he died. I said, well, I'll hang on. I'll get the report for you. I had the autopsy report in a file. I went through and I said, yes, he was hit with shotgun blasts to the back and the lower abdomen, and he took 15 minutes before he died. So yes, I would say he suffered for 15 minutes. Okay, and that's what he wanted to know, and he hung up, but he phoned back in about 5 minutes and with more questions, and I answered those. And then he phoned back a third time to say that the conversation was off the record. And I said, well, yeah, I guess it is, but you're the one phoning me for the information. There's no story here. I mean, this guy, McDonald, was a friend of yours. You wanted to know how he died. I gave you the goods on that. And that's how that chat ended. And then shortly after that, it might have been a month or so, I can't recall, I was in the newsroom at CBC, and my office line rang. It was 10 o'clock on this particular morning, and it was a collect call from this penitentiary north of Winnipeg. It was David Milgaard. So I accepted the call. And he told me that he had fired his lawyer, Hirsch Walsh. And that would be a huge news story, because Hirsch Walsh is a famous criminal defense lawyer, and he'd been with David Milgaard from day one. And I thought, whoa, this is a big story. So I recorded the interview on my old trusty Sony 142 tape recorder.
With actual tape, right?
yeah, it was tape. It was
Remember
cool.
We used tape?
And I was totally unexpected, totally not expecting that call like that. So I tried to probe him for details. I said, what does your mother think of that? And he said, I don't know, I haven't told her, but I'm mad at her too. What does your lawyer say? But he said, I haven't told him yet. Okay. So, you know, you can fire someone, as we call it, through the media. He could do that. It's not the way I would do it. I would phone the lawyer. But in any case, it was his choice. And he went on about his grievances. And that was pretty well the end of the interview. Next day, the phone rings. I'm sitting at the desk, same time. And I knew it had to be Milgaard. And it was. Another collect call. First thing he says, did you run that interview? And I said, no, I didn't. Oh, thank God, he said. We had a big meeting last night, all of us, and we sorted everything out. Thank God you didn't run it. Why didn't you run it? You had it. And I said, yes, I did. I have it right here. I didn't run it, David, because you sounded anxious. Something told me you were just upset, so I didn't run it. And he said, well, thank you. I said, it's no big deal. He said, no, man, I owe you one. I said, no, you certainly don't owe me anything. Why don't you help a stranger? How's that? He said, no, man, I owe you one. Remember how insistent he was. So not long after that, he's released from the penitentiary. And he gets outside the pen. He gets into the car of his lawyer. And he's surrounded by media people. I would guess maybe, and I don't know, I wasn't there, but 50 maybe cameramen, print reporters, radio guys, TV guys. You know, they surrounded the vehicle and asked for comments. They wanted an interview, and he would not comment. So they drove him to his mother's townhouse in Winnipeg. And when he got there, he phoned Byron for his first interview. And that was major, because he wouldn't speak to anybody afterwards for several days. He just was quiet, talked to any reporters. And years later, this pop group out of Kingston, Ontario, the Tragically Hip.
I've heard of those guys. I have heard of those guys, yes.
I had heard of them too, but I'm not into pop music so much. But David had met them, and he's friends with, I think, the drummer. But they did a song about David Milgaard called Wheat Kings. And there's a line in there a late breaking story on the CBC. And that was, and I'm thankful to the group for giving credit to us, because quite often, you know, people don't give credit, but they did. And it was because the CBC was mentioned in so many different stories, whether it was Canadian Press or the Toronto Star. And credit went to CBC with that exclusive interview with David Milgaard. That's why it, there's mention of it in the song, I'm told. Now, I don't follow that group, and I found out about it one night. I was working the desk in the evening, and a phone call came in from a reporter in Calgary, and he had heard the song, and he brought it to my attention. Otherwise, I may not have, you know, heard it for years later. But when David comes to Edmonton, he stays with me, and he likes to hear that song. He makes a little thing of it and says, you know, we're both mentioned here in the same song, and that's kind of neat. And I said, yeah, I guess it is. Yeah, so. But that's the background to getting to know David Milgaard initially, and it was very negative, of course, with the news coverage of his conviction of the murder. And then I worked on stories having to do with his release and had interviewed him when he was in the joint and even passed down a scoop. But it turned out to be a huge benefit to pass down that scoop.
No
pass
kidding.
On it. Yeah, it was huge.
I mean, quite an honor, too, for him to make good on that. I owe you one favor, you know, and even though you didn't feel that way, you know, and he said, no, I'm going to make good on that. And then you get the first interview. So that's quite, you know, quite honorable, you know, towards you. It was certainly, he was paying homage to you. And then the song, Wheat Kings, I've known for years and years, and never knowing that there was, you know, maybe a 1 degree separation in there. And then when I found out that
it's funny, isn't it?
Yeah. It is. And what's, you know, like there's just, we're all connected, as they say, you know? So, but now you are part of, I mean, that song itself is part of Canadiana, you know, and what Tragically Hip, and of course the lead singer, Gord Downie, with being diagnosed with brain cancer and stuff. I mean, it's a different time now with all of their music. Yeah. It's all being looked at in a different way. But I mean, now that song will go down in history and you will be part of that as well, you know? So that's kind of nice to think about, wouldn't you say?
I think it is, but it strikes me as still odd. You know, I remember being in a record store, or they sold CDs then. It was a large one here at West Edmonton Mall, the big shopping center in Edmonton. And I was in there trying to buy something, and they were playing music. And the song came over, Wheat Kings. So I'm standing there, and I'm waiting for the punchline. And there's a woman standing to my left, and I wanted to say, hey, that's about my work.
I know.
But I didn't do it because she'd think I was crazy.
She wouldn't have believed
it. It seemed like a funny moment. At that point, I hadn't even owned the CD. It had been out for a couple of years. I finally bought it. And when David comes there, he does play that. He enjoys hearing it.
You're listening to Down Home Corner. Thanks for listening. Please share this show on social media. And thank you for your support. Now back to our program, this episode with Byron Christopher, where we continue our conversation about his interview and friendship with David Milgaard.
One of the great things about that is you got to see the human side, the real side, you know, the little gems, as you call them, you know?
Yeah,
and you've
got
a great story about a Burton Cummings song and David Milgaard.
Oh, yeah. David visited the house one time, and I forget what the occasion was. I think he was in Vancouver then, and I said I was teaching at one of the universities here, teaching journalism, and do you want to come up and talk to my students? And he hummed and hawed, and I said, David, you know, I'd appreciate it if you think of other people more than yourself, you know? And, you know, he got in his car, and he drove all night to get up here. He slept on the couch, and he was just sort of out of it. And he did go to the class, and he gave a good talk, you know, getting credit. And it was around that time, my house is a three-level split, and the main floor has a wooden floor, not the laminate flooring, it's the old-fashioned flooring, and there's a nice covering of lac on it, so it's nice and smooth. And on that floor, I have a boombox or a ghetto blaster, and there was a CD there, and it was playing some music. And David was alone on the floor and standing there, and listening to the music and sort of gliding on the floor softly with his eyes closed, and I could hear the song. And it was called Break It To Them Gently, and I'd like that song. But I hadn't really listened to the words, you know, and he was gliding away, And I thought, that's nice. And then I heard the words. I paid attention to them. It's about someone on the run from the law. Mm. I didn't realize that before. And I mentioned that to him later. I said, that's a nice song. He said, I like it. I like the melody, he says. You know, but, you know, in fact, it was more than the melody. The words were touching. Whenever I hear that song, I can just see David on the living room floor gliding backwards with his eyes closed, listening to that tune. It comes back every time I hear it.
Do you know if Burton Cummings ever heard of the story or has any idea about this?
No. You're about the only one I've told it to.
Wow. Well, myself and my listeners are honored.
Yeah. No, I haven't told anyone that story. There's another one, funny one. I brought him over to the big shopping center in Edmonton called West Edmonton Mall. How big is it? It's about the size of Campbellton. It's a massive mall, thousands of shops. And they have funny things in there, you know. I mean, they're meant to amuse the children and adults and that. But and I remember one time they had these twisted mirrors that were shaped funny. And as you walked by, you could have a skinny body or a huge head or whatever. Well, David stood in front of that stupid mirror, killing himself laughing. I mean, the kids were laughing. They got a kick out of that. But he was the only adult who was really getting off on it, you know. And he was bending over and just laughing and laughing. And people were laughing at him because he was out of place, you know. So I said to one person, I said, I don't mind that guy. He's been in a prison for 50 years. He just got out. He's never seen this stuff. It was meant to be a joke. But they took it as a joke.
Of course.
The fact was, he was in there 20-some years. They had no idea who he was.
See, another thing is, too, is you got to see, I'm sure that anybody who'd be in prison for 23 years, when they got out and felt freedom, there would be a childlike exuberance going on. You must have seen a lot of that.
Yeah, I did. In fact, he phoned me. He was in New Brunswick. He did a bit of a tour of Canada, bumming around. He phoned me from Moncton because he had spent time at a penitentiary at Dorchester, near Moncton. So he returned to Moncton, and he phoned me, and he said, is there anyone you know down here I could visit? I said, well, it's funny you should mention that, because my brother, Arnold, lives in Moncton. Okay, what's his address? I give him the address. Sure enough, he drops around to see my brother. Now, Arnold is not into news. If you would ask him, was the president of the U.S., you'd have to think, I don't know, did he ever play hockey? My brother just did sports, you know. He'll tell you how old Gordie Howe was when he died, what he died from, what his last words were, but don't ask him anything to do with any news at all. So he arrives at the door, and Arnold tells me the story. He said, this guy arrives here, and I said, who are you? And he said, David Milgaard. And at this point, Milgaard had been in every newspaper in Canada. He's only been released for a few weeks. And Arnold says, I never heard of him. I said, well, what'd you do? He says, well, I invited him in. He had another girl with him. She's a bit of a bimbo. Anyway, we came in here, and he's a nervous sort. So I give him a few drinks, and it loosened him up. He wanted to hear some music, so we cranked up the music. We're all dancing here in the living room. I thought, what the hell? This is out of the Trailer Park Boys.
That's so down home. I love it. It's so down home.
These strangers meeting and they have a few, they get liquored up and they crank up the old stereo and they're dancing away on the floor, you know?
I'm expecting the next question is, do you have a place to stay tonight? Well, I'm not sure. You got a place. Shut up, okay?
Yeah, I know. But it was a down homer kind of stuff, you know? And Milgaard, it's a long, funny story. He escaped from that penitentiary at Dorchester, him and two other kids. They put these bed sheets together and they got over the wall. But they didn't get far. They got as far as a farmhouse, maybe half a mile away. And they broke in, and there's an older couple in there. I love telling this story to David because it seems so childish. You know, it's funny to laugh at it. But the couple knew that they were escapees, but they were just like young kids in their early 20s or so. And they made them wash the floors and do the dishes, and they scolded them for any foul language. You know, isn't that a crazy story? Only in Canada would escapees, you know, be forced to do the dishes after they busted out of prison.
And they were very polite doing it, too, I must admit. Well, you can't refuse. It's Canada.
David said they scolded them for using foul language. I said, yeah, they would. And then the police came and took them back. You know, whatever. That was sort of the gist of it. I don't know if it's 100% accurate, but you get the general feeling and flow of that story.
I'll look for the story on your blog.
Yeah, quite a few little moments there, David Melgaard. But you're right. You do get to know the person behind the headlines and But many of the stories, you know, I just haven't told. They're in my head. But the one about the song by Burton Cummings, I hadn't told that to anyone. And I was pleased that you had heard of that song. I thought, well, okay. I didn't want you to say, I've never heard of that song, but apparently you did. And I'm pleased that you know it.
Know it well.
Yeah, I like it. But I did get to know David. We got along fairly well. When he got out of penitentiary, he arrived at my door in Edmonton. I thought, what are you doing here? And he stood there in sock feet. I said, where the hell are your shoes? You know? He said, I sold them for cigarettes. Oh, okay. So he was a bit dysfunctional, you know, but nonetheless, I said, you're going in the shower. So he jumped in the tub and you could hear him singing away in there. And I thought, this is weird, you know? But he was himself. And I got him a place to stay that night at a hostel downtown. I'm driving down one of the busy freeways in Edmonton, summertime. About 10:30 at night, dark, going down this freeway and going down the hill, in fact. And David is singing away to himself. He's got the window down on his side, and he's got his head outside the window, and he's singing away. And I thought, geez, I hope nobody sees this. Yeah, that's rather embarrassing. Here I am driving a car from 1937. What am I talking about? You know, I was getting a lot of attention. There's David with his head stuck out the window, and I thought, hey, cool it. He's free, you know? I don't know what he's been through. I really can't relate to it. But he continued to come to Edmonton. Then he moved to Vancouver. He got married and married a gal from Saskatoon, Marnie. And he was, at that point, still a prisoner, just out on parole. And for him to travel anywhere, he needed permission. So he called one day. He said, would you phone my parole officer? I'd like to meet you in Jasper. It would be nice to hang out in the mountains for a couple of days. I said, well, I'll phone your parole officer. And I spoke to the lady. She was good about it. And I said, I'd pick up your client in Jasper, and I'll take him down into the mountains, and we'll do some camping. She was cool with that. So I pick up David in Jasper, and the first thing I see him standing in the snow in sock feet. I said, have you sold your shoes again? He said, yep, I got some smokes. So I figured that I've got extra shoes for you. So we go to a camping spot that's totally illegal. You know, it's off grid, hidden down in the trees. There's a meadow and there's a river going by, and there's snow-capped mountains and that. And there's a lot of some dead trees there. So I took the axe to one of them, a really tall tree, and chopped it down to come crashing down in the riverbed. And David says, what have you done, man? You just cut down a tree in a national park. I said, that's right. I said, hold this axe. So he does. And I said, and here you are holding the axe, and you're the convicted murderer. I got no problems with that, David. That's funny, you know. And but then we were, I was splitting the wood, and I was trying to organize. There was a guy there from the Oilers, there were three of us. And David was content to enjoy a cold beer and sit there and look at the mountains, you know. And there was a stream going by, and he would be standing over the stream, and he's looking down at the fish. The trout, and he would run over and say, there's two fish here, and then he'd go back and he'd say, there's three, I found three. And this went on like for like half an hour, maybe 45 minutes. He's running back and forth, and the guy with the Oilers, or Mark Lewis, said, what the hell's with that guy? Why is he talking about the fish, you know? And I said, Mark, in a penitentiary, fish represent freedom. That's why in each of the units, or used to be in a federal pen, they had fish tanks. The boys had fish tanks. And it was just symbolic of freedom. And I remember one of the units at the Max B unit where there were three tanks, fish, a small one, one a bit bigger, and a bigger one. There were three of them. And the boys had marked on them minimum, medium, and maximum presence. That's funny. So it was pretty cool, but he got to see David a little bit, and then he settled down and he said, you know, I wish he was here. And he said, my dad, I always wanted to go fishing with my dad, Lauren. I said, yeah. So he said, you know, I was shot once. I said, yeah, I think I heard that. Policeman shot you in the back. He said, no, it wasn't in the back. It was in my ass. I said, I don't really care to see it, David. But yeah, sure enough, he got shot in the ass. He said, the funny thing about it was that, he said, when the bullet hit me, I could feel it hit me, and then I could hear the sound later. I said, okay, I guess good to keep that in mind if I'm ever shot from a distance. But he was not very energetic, you know, he's more reflective and liked to enjoy a cold beer. I said, David, do you care to cut up some wood, split some wood? Okay, get him a wood and a stump, and he's splitting away, and he splits it all up nicely. He said, there you go. And I said, is that it? Do you want to do more? He said, do you want me to do more? And I said, well, you work it out, buddy. We're here for 3 days. It would be nice to have a good supply of wood. Oh, okay. And he grumbled about it. And I said, David, now I know that you didn't kill Gail Miller. And he stopped. He said, how do you know that, smartass? I said, you're too lazy to kill anyone.
See my baby sister, be as kind as you can. And break it to my grandma, said that boy's wild and bad. Break it to them gently when you tell them that I won't be coming home again. 'Cause I'm running with a gun and it isn't any fun as a fugitive.
Roll it to my grandma. Gotta roll the old lady. Roll it Break It to Them Gently by Burton Cummings. A Canadian classic, or Canadian gold, as they used to call it back in the day. But I was thinking, how cool would it be at this point to have David Milgaard on the show? You know, to talk about Byron as a journalist and as a friend, and how the tragically hip song Wheat Kings came about. Eh, but David Milgaard just doesn't do interviews. Search the internet. I bet you can't find 5 interviews with David Milgaard. But how cool would it be to have him on the show? You know, sometimes, if a down-homer wishes really hard...
Well, David Milgaard, thank you so much for being on Down Home Corner. I want to just tell you that it's an honor to have you on the show, and I think you're a hero and an inspiration to many Canadians. Thank you for being here.
Oh, thank you, Steve, for asking me to be on the show.
Now, you've known Byron Christopher for over 20 years now as a journalist and then later as a good and loyal friend. What's your opinion of Byron as a journalist, and what did it mean to have him covering your story all those years ago?
Thinking back to my situation and my relationship with Byron, you know, it kind of started in a strange way. I somehow got a card or something from him, and I remember that I was inside, and there was a friend of mine that ended up getting shot inside the prison. And I just wondered, you know, about that situation. And I asked Byron if he would find out, you know, just how long, you know, this man had suffered before he died. They just shot everybody up inside, right? And I remember that. The second part is also kind of an interesting story, too. You know, at one point, I was really upset with my mom. I was upset with my lawyer. And I called Byron. I said, listen, I got a scoop for you. I fired my lawyer. And he said, well, have you done it yet, David? And I said, no, not yet. I said, I'm mad at my mom. I'm mad at everybody. So I guess he didn't go with it, which was good, because I called him at the last minute and said, Byron, tell me that you didn't go with the story. And he said, no, David, I didn't, because I just thought that, you know, I would wait until I heard from you again. And after that, you know, I was loyal to Byron. You know, when I first got out, I made sure that Byron was the person that I would talk to. And I guess that was the first exposure Canadians, I don't know how to say Canadians. To me, it's like we're all a big family here in this country. And it was my first kind of exposure to everybody in the country. And I really liked Byron, the way he kind of handled things. And I admire him as a person just because, the best way to talk about Byron is just say he has a very big heart. He's always reaching around and helping people wherever he is. He's always got somebody there that he's trying to make a difference in their lives.
Yeah, he actually cares, and he cared about your story as well, because he told me that he didn't run the story because he felt you were agitated. And he said he was going to wait and see what happened. So a lot of journalists would have just went ahead and, you know, there's my scoop, I'm going to go with it. And, you know, the retraction would have been another story, and we'll run with that. But that's not how Byron was.
Yeah, Byron's he's a pretty smart individual. And I also think that, you know, I remember at one point he asked me to speak to some journalist students for him in Edmonton. And in doing a little bit of research before I did my talk, there's a lot of ethics involved in being a journalist. And I think those are the measures by which Byron was cautious, and I'm glad that he was.
He carries a lot of what we call East Coast values, you know?
I like East Coast values. I've been down that way. I really, really have to be honest with you. Down in Newfoundland, right, it's kind of a special place because you're always getting this Lord lifting Jesus boy, how are you? You know, from total strangers, you know? And you have to say, well, I'm all right. How are you, you know? And it was really, really nice to, and, you know, it doesn't matter where you are, New Brunswick, Nova Scotia. You know, you're always going to find people there that are caring and kind. I think the majority of people are good people. And it took me a while to get my walking legs when I got out of prison to kind of realize that and kind of trust that. But, you know, I did. And I'm I don't know how to explain. It's just a matter of taking your life and putting it in order and having priorities and making sure that you're a person that is a doer and getting things done. Because if you really make up your mind to be a doer, you can do anything. You really can with your life.
Mm. Well, you know, like Byron and you and Byron have become friends over the years, and he's been a champion for human rights as well and for the wrongly convicted, as well as you are.
Yeah, he has been. I know that Byron has and continues to make efforts to assist the wrongfully convicted, and I'm proud to say that he does so.
So when you were released from prison, you had decided you weren't going to talk to any other journalists. You were going to make sure that Byron would be the first.
Yeah, I did that.
And that's where the line in the tragically hip song Wheat Kings, a late-breaking story on the CBC, they're referring to Byron.
Well, that's quite possible. I never thought of that. I know right now it's a sad situation with Greg Dowdy because he has cancer. And he came to see me, and he was a quiet, very very soft-spoken person, and so was I at that point in my life, and I still believe that I am. I try to be, anyway. But I felt like, wow, here's the tragically hip, and they're talking to me about wanting to put a song together. And, you know, I listened to the tragically hip music. I always listened to it, and, you know, the way he is, it's always, you know, it's a rock beat, and he's always moving around ideationally with his words and stuff. And he comes out with this beautiful ballad for me. And, you know, I just, when I listen to that song, it just makes me feel, oh, I don't know a good word for it, kind of at peace in a way. I really like those loons when it starts with the loons, because that was my dad's favorite bird, and my favorite bird. And, yeah, I really I wish him well, and I care for him, and I hope he understands that and knows it.
Yeah, so I had wondered how the song had come about. I'd wondered if they had written the song and then contacted you, or if they spoke to you first and then. So you said Gore Downie came and met you, and that's where the inspiration for the song came from. Very interesting. Do you feel a lot of the lines in the song relate to you and your situation?
Yeah, I think so. I really do. I remember at that point I was doing a documentary with a gentleman named Vic Sarin, and I was staying at Vic Sarin's place, and that's where I met them.
What I like about the song, and it's funny too, because I'm just going to share this with you, but I've listened to this song literally hundreds of times, and that's no exaggeration. I've always loved that song by Tragically Hip, and I've loved the band for years as well. But I've heard it in four different contexts now, like four different sets of ears, if you would. You know, like the first time I heard it, it was, oh, this is a cool song by the hip, you know? And then down the road, I found out what the subject matter was about you and your story. And then it took on a deeper meaning. You know, I was kind of moved a lot more by it. And then I found out about Byron being the line late-breaking story on the CBC. It took on a new meaning. And then last night when I spoke to you, I don't know what it is, but I went back. I came home after work, and I sat down, and I put the headphones on, and I listened to the song about three or four times. And I sat down, and I cried. And I had never felt that song at that level. I had never seen the sadness in that song the way I had seen it right there, and I'd never felt the pain like I had felt in that. And it was a beautiful feeling to experience that. But what gets me most about the song is the opening line and the final line. In the opening line, he says, "Sundown in the Paris of the prairies." I imagine him imagining you looking out your cell, you know? That's the way I saw that line.
No. I need to say this, right, because it's true. You know, there are so many people, and still, you know, there are people that care about myself and my mother and my family. And, you know, to feel it so emotionally, Canadians, you know, are people that believe in what's right and just. And, you know, the fact that I would look around me and I would see so much love in people's faces for us is really a tribute to the people in the country that are believing in what's right and just. And, you know, I really feel the need to say that, because there are people now that will be listening to this podcast, and they will think about that, and they'll say, yes, you know, I do believe in what's right and just, and it's an honorable thing to know that so many people in this country feel the way they do.
Yeah, and what I love about it, too, is the very last line. I didn't hear or even see that line the way I did until last night, and I realized that he just changes one word in there, and he, like, all through it, he says, let's see what tomorrow brings in the chorus. And then in this one, he says, wheat kings and pretty things, oh, that's what tomorrow brings. So it gives a feeling of hope at the very end, you know, and that's very moving, you know. So, like, the way I see it all in the picture, now I might be totally off base, but you can tell me if I'm close or not. But the way I see it is that he's portraying your loneliness in prison, you know, and seeing it and trying and being beaten down, but not giving up hope. And then at the very end saying, okay, let's, tomorrow, yeah, it's going to be tomorrow. How does that for
it's,
you?
It's the reality. You know, prison is a horrible place, and of course I felt lonely in there a lot. I think what people need to know is that there's so many people that are sitting right now in cells and are wrongfully convicted in Canada, and the system that's there that the Minister of Justice and the Justice Department have doesn't work. It is non-functional, and these people are not getting out of prison. And we do need, it's very important, an independent board of review that's going to take these cases and move them quickly, have them investigated, and once they can demonstrate for sure that a person is innocent, not guilty of anything, they can release them. They have the power to release them immediately. The present system is defunct. It's just a horrible way of trying to treat people that have been wrongfully convicted. Think about it yourself. Mm. If you were wrongfully convicted, Steve, and the process by which you are supposed to try to get out of prison doesn't work, it's like having the whole thing take place all over again. It's a horrible situation, and I speak out about it as much as I can, and it's important that I make that point on this podcast.
You've made a great point, you know, and it's so wonderful that you decide to go out and to be a champion for these things, because no one would blame you if you just went off and said, look, let me leave my life now. And I went through enough pain, because I'm sure talking about it and going through a lot of that, it must trigger a lot of PTSD things and a lot of different bad memories. So, you know, you should be commended for the help that you are doing in that way. And just having your face out there really brings a lot of awareness. So thank you on behalf of Canadians.
I just kind of figure myself to be an ordinary person that would do the same thing themselves. The problem is every time that I go someplace or I do speak, I'm always having a mother come up to me and saying, my son is wrongfully convicted. And, you know, I'm not just an ordinary human being. I can't really make a difference in those situations other than to just, you know, kind of pass whatever I can onto these people to get them some kind of assistance or help. And I really, really feel the need to reach out right now to people that are listening. And, you know, this is a problem, because we really are talking about a man that has a great big heart, and that, you know, here's the quickest way to kind of, for me to kind of end up here with you. We're talking about Byron, but the bottom line is, you know, if you're a person that's kind of stuck in a situation where you really have no hope and you don't know what to do, right? If you got Byron Christopher, you know, trying to help you, right? Well, you got something happening for you and you got hope. You know, that's the best way to kind of point out Byron. And, you know, I've had some good times with Byron. I'll probably have some better times with Byron. I hope I do. He needs to come and see me soon and bring down his canoe again, and we can go out canoeing with my kids. I think that would be a great idea.
Well, I hope you and your kids and him get to go to Campbellton someday, and he can take you up the Sugarloaf Mountain.
That would be great. That would be really, really good.
Well, thank you for sharing your thoughts about Byron and also your insight and thoughts about the song Wheat Kings, because as I say, I'm not kidding you, it's been one of my favorite Tragically Hip songs for years. So this podcast goes out around the world, and if you don't believe me, we have 3 listeners in the country of Ghana. Now, who in the world is in Ghana listening to our podcast about Down Home East Canada? is beyond me, but the statistics show. And
that's good. I'm glad that a lot of people are part
of this. So if having said that, is there anything you'd like to say to the Tragically Hip if there's by chance that some member of the band is going to hear this podcast or somebody connected?
Well, if they do, I hope that, you know, those that are listening, you know, have some prayers for Greg Downer. And to know that the people that are going to work to help him, the doctors, you know, are going to do a good job, and that he does recover and he becomes completely healthy. That's my prayer for him, and I wish the rest of the Tragically Hip well. They're all out of Kingston. They're all five married, and I'm sure that in their own way they're all trying to their very best to kind of corral and protect Craig.
Well, David, you're a pretty hip kind of guy yourself. Thanks for being on the program, and thanks for everything that you've done for us. And I hope that Byron and I and you get to go camping someday.
Well, that's interesting. Thank you very much, Steve, for your time, too.
Sundown in the Paris of the prairie, we kings of all treasures buried. All you hear are the rusty breezes pushing around the weather vane Jesus. The Zippo lighter, he sees the killer's face. Maybe it's someone standing in a killer's place. 20 years for nothing, well, that's nothing new. Besides, no one's interested in something you didn't do. We kings and pretty things. Let's just see. Dreamy dreams where the high school's dead and start. It's a museum and we're all locked up in it after dark. The walls are lined all yellow, gray, and sinister, hung with pictures of our parents' prime ministers. We came and pretty things. Wait and see what tomorrow brings. Late breaking story on the CBC. A nation whispers we always knew that he'd go free. They add you can't be fond of living in the past. 'Cause if you are, then there's no way that you're gonna last. We kings and pretty things. Let's just see.
By the Tragically Hip, a song inspired by the plight of David Melgard. You know, saying that the David Milgaard story had a happy ending wouldn't be quite accurate. There are some happy aspects to the ending, of course. David finally freed, exonerated, and then given a huge settlement by the Saskatchewan government. The Milgaard story, at least the ending, is bittersweet at best. Nothing could make up for 23 years of a living hell, and unjustly so at that, and then fighting a system that doesn't lend itself well to overturning the wrongfully convicted. Consider the DNA evidence, for instance, that convicted Larry Fisher and exonerated David had only been saved because a prosecutor had wanted to write a book about the trial. DNA testing only became reliable in a court of law, beginning in Britain in 1986. But in the three short conversations I had with David Milgaard, I learned a number of things, but this is what impressed me most. He never lost his humanity, in spite of all that he went through. And I think he's still a proud Canadian, and he's proud that Canadians supported him in his plight. I'm honored to have had David on the show, and I thank Byron Christopher for setting up that interview. I'd like to tell you I went out and dug and made lots of phone calls and worked till I got that interview, but that's not how it came about. It came about because of the friendship between Byron Christopher and David Milgaard. And again, I'm honored to have had that conversation and to have had that interview. And that's our show. My thanks to my guests, Byron Christopher and David Milgaard. Thank you for listening. Episode 2 will bring Byron back to talk about Richard Lee McNair. That's the escaped convict on America's Most Wanted list, captured in all places, Campbellton, New Brunswick. Fascinating story. And Byron was the man who got the interview with McNair. It led to a book and a six-part series in the Campbellton Tribune. One of the highlights is when Byron gives us the play-by-play of the RCMP's high-speed chase through the streets of Campbellton. Episode 2 of Season 2. Please, right now, share this show on social media like Facebook or Twitter, and go to our Facebook page and like us, because we like you. I'm Steve Bijou, a down-homer, and if you're a down-homer, remember, we are all connected.